This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. President Trump raised some eyebrows recently when he speculated that the Civil War could have been avoided, he said, and implied that people haven't really looked closely at what caused that conflict.
Margaret Story is a professor of history at DePaul University in Chicago. She specializes in the American Civil War and the South. She says it's critical for leaders and policymakers to know and learn from history. Margaret, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I want to start by giving a listen to the president's comments about Andrew Jackson and the Civil War. Here's a listen.
I mean, had Andrew Jackson been a little bit later, you wouldn't have had the Civil War. He was a very tough person, but he had a big heart, and he was really angry that he saw what was happening with regard to the Civil War. He said, there's no reason for this. People don't realize, you know, the Civil War. You think about it, why? People don't ask that question. But why was there the Civil War? Why could that one not have been worked out?
So as a historian specializing in the American Civil War, what was your reaction when you first heard those quotes?
I was baffled. There are so many aspects of what he said that are confusing and inaccurate. And it was just truly stunning.
We can dig into the details in a bit, but is it important that the president have an understanding of this part of American history? We're not looking for a history professor in chief, I guess. What worries you if he's getting things wrong?
It's very important that the president understands our history. For one, we're a democratic republic. And because of that, we're a citizen-led government. And we all understand the importance of history to citizenship, to engage citizenship. One would imagine that the president is the most engaged citizen of all. So from my point of view and from my co-author's point of view, we really felt that we should say that the president needs to be informed, especially about the Civil War, which probably more than any other event in our history has shaped who we are as a country for good and for ill.
The idea that if Andrew Jackson or someone like him had been in place, we might have figured out a deal to avoid the Civil War. What do you think? There were a lot of efforts to make deals to avoid a Civil War over the years.
Yeah. I mean, first of all, the Congress of the United States struggled from 1824 to make a deal to avoid the Civil War. It was the consuming political problem of the 40 years prior to the Civil War. So many, many, many people strove to avoid a war. But even more significantly is that the question itself betrays the fact that the president seems to have no understanding of the place of slavery in that crisis. And it, of course, was central. And it's particularly ironic that he should cast Jackson as a potential savior for the Union in that context, because Jackson, of course, was the signer of the Indian Removal Act in 1830, which forcibly removed Indians, various tribes that were living in the Southeast, off their land so that those lands could be settled by slaveholders in the South. So the expansion of slavery, which becomes central to the crisis that provokes the Civil War, the expansion of slavery westward, was facilitated directly by Andrew Jackson's acts as president.
Right. Let's talk about that issue of slavery and the Civil War. And a lot of the debate, as you say, wasn't just about should slavery be legal or illegal, but should new states be able to expand slavery? Should new states be free or
exactly.
slave states? Can you talk
exactly.
a little more about that conflict?
Yeah. As the country settled and took the lands that were west of the initial area of settlement when the American Revolution happened, it is not surprising that the people who were already living there resisted, and there were efforts to move Indians off of those lands. But as those people were moved forcibly off of those lands, farmers moved west, both in the free states and in the slave states. And the big challenge, of course, for many people politically, was that increasingly, people were uncomfortable with the system of slavery in the North. I want to be careful to say that we had a broad anti-slavery sentiment there, not a broad abolitionist sentiment, meaning people who wanted to end slavery right then and right there, unconditionally. There's a small proportion of people who lived in the free states who endorsed that idea. But the majority of white people who lived in the North were becoming somewhat more uncomfortable with the place of slavery in the national discourse. This is particularly true in the Congress because the basis of representation in the Congress was population. And of course, at the founding, the Constitution set up a system whereby part of the slave population was counted towards representation in the Congress and in the Electoral College. And so it mattered whether or not slaves were in various states. This becomes a major struggle amongst people in Congress and in citizens in the United States. The Missouri Compromise of 1820 is the first real battle over this, but it continues all the way through the 1840s. The war with Mexico brings lands into the United States. That, in turn, becomes a focal point for considerable political and partisan argument over the place of slavery in the national economy and society.
Let's talk about Andrew Jackson as a presidential role model. This isn't the first time President Trump has talked about him. He was a hero for the 19th century, anyway, Democratic Party and beyond, as a guy who broadened the electorate in some ways, brought people into politics who weren't there. And that's something that Donald Trump, that people have pointed toward him doing that as part of his recipe for success. Apart from policies on slavery and Native American removal, can you talk about that side of Andrew Jackson?
Sure. Jackson's associated with a democratizing trend in American politics. This democratizing trend was underway before Jackson and carried on past Jackson. He took advantage of a whole mess of changes that occurred in the economy and technology and in society that were democratizing in their general direction. Our historical story says that the election of 1828, the one in which Jackson was made president, was a particularly high point for participation among the electorate. And this is quite true. At that point, the United States had probably broader, what was called then universal manhood suffrage, which of course is misleading because it wasn't universal. It was white male suffrage. But that was very broad relative to history in general. So this is quite true that there was a much broader participation among the white male voting population. This is accurate. But the point is that there were also deep and problematic elements of that franchise. It happened despite the fact that many other men were not enfranchised, namely men of African descent, both free and slave. Women, of course, were not included in that. And as we've developed as a country, we've embraced those expansions. So the country we are now embraces that expansion. That expansion occurred in all different decades with many, many people at the wheel, right? So Jackson, to pick Jackson out as a hero, is, for my mind, I can see some elements of why he would do that, but I also see it as very limiting and strange in some ways. The many, many leaders that you could focus on as being heroes to popular participation in our government, I wouldn't pick Jackson as the first one.
Talking to history professor Margaret Story from DePaul University about history and the presidency. And Margaret, people point toward another dark side of Andrew Jackson. As I understand the Indian removal, that was a presidential conflict with the Supreme Court. A Supreme Court ruling, do I have this right, was ignored by that president.
Right. And it's key to understand why Jackson did that. When he came to office, there had been quite a few years of strife between newer southern states, so deep south states, particularly Georgia, but others, conflict between those states and the existing president at the time, John Quincy Adams, over whether or not the federal government was going to intervene on the state's behalf to in conflicts with Indians who were resident in those areas. Jackson, part of how Jackson built his base was to appease these southern states by supporting them against the Supreme Court and against the Indians who had standing, both in law and, we might argue, just simply in morality, and supported those states in removing Indians from those lands so that white settlers could take those lands and grow more cotton. the interesting thing is that the one southern state that didn't really get appeased was South Carolina. And South Carolina became the focal point of conflict with Andrew Jackson over what was called nullification. And that, of course, is where Jackson makes his name as a unionist. He defends the union against this resistance on the part of South Carolina. But underlying that is a real consolidation of Jackson's power by really appeasing southern states who are quite hostile to Indians' presence and also quite invested in the continuance and expansion of slavery.
Let's bring things back to the present day. Does a president, if he or she fails to understand history, are they prone to making poor decisions in the present and future?
I'm a historian, so I believe so. One can understand history deeply and make mistakes. This is not what I'm suggesting. What I'm suggesting and what I think my colleague Tom and I were trying to refer to in the piece that we wrote was that there's an ethical responsibility to try to understand the past as best as you can, as honestly as you can, to inform yourself to the best of your ability about the causes and potential consequences of your actions. And that is an ethical responsibility of historians, it's an ethical responsibility of citizens, and it's a very profound responsibility of the president.
Yeah, you mentioned citizens, and I wanted to conclude on that. Why should the rest of us, non-presidents, non-leaders of this country, maybe pay more attention to history and its lessons?
History is a way for us to understand why things happened. Sometimes I think what we do when we go to school and we're maybe given lists of things to memorize and we may get bored and not find this very interesting, you know? But history is really not about just what happened, but about why it happened and why that matters over time. So the sense of an arc that the little disparate events of human life and society have greater meaning when you understand them in relationship to one another than they can on their own is a way to have greater insight about the meaning of our world and what the future might hold. We can't predict the future from studying history, but we can understand human tendencies and human failures and human potential by studying history. And so for all of us who are invested in a brighter future, history is a very important foundation for building those dreams.
We'll leave it there for now. Margaret, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Margaret Story is a professor of history at DePaul University. She specializes in the American Civil War and the South. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferris.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Obesity in America has been regarded as a health epidemic for years, and a lot of the blame has been placed on our country's fast food culture. And fast food and obesity are more prevalent in low-income urban areas where healthier food options may not exist.
A new book finds that government policy was behind an urban fast food boom in the 1960s, 70s, and 80s. Washington spent millions to help the industry expand into inner cities with the goal of kickstarting urban economies.
Chin Jo is with us now. She's a lecturer in American history at the University of Sydney and the author of the book Supersizing Urban America, How Inner Cities Got Fast Food with Government Help. Chin, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me, Veronica.
Well, first of all, how big an issue is obesity for the low-income, largely minority communities that you looked at, and how does that compare to other, maybe more affluent areas?
Yeah, well, first of all, I should point out that rates of obesity are higher across the board for people of all ethnic backgrounds in terms of socioeconomic status. So, lower-income white Americans, for instance, also tend to have higher rates of obesity, especially when we're looking at women and children, than their higher-income counterparts. In terms of African Americans, which is the group that I look at primarily, we do see stark disparities in rates of obesity, particularly among women and children, not quite as much among men, But it is a problem that disproportionately affects African Americans. I should point out that among women, even when we control for socioeconomic status, African American women have slightly higher rates of obesity than white women.
And your book makes the case that the story of urban areas and fast food begins with the riots of the late 60s. What is the connection there? Why start there?
Yeah. So first, I should point out that you had fast food companies approaching the U.S. federal government for assistance in their minority enterprise initiative. So they were trying to enlist African-American franchisees. And we see that as early as 1964, there was a chain called Chicken Delight in which they approached the Commerce Department for assistance with that. But it really isn't until the riots of the mid to late 1960s, starting with Watts, which is a district in Los Angeles in 1965, that the Johns administration has this new sense of urgency about the need to develop economically develop African-American communities. Some of your listeners may know Johnson was also interested in eradicating poverty with his War on Poverty program, which also included rural, primarily white communities as well. But in any case, after Watts, Johnson dispatched some federal officials to the Los Angeles area and also to Oakland to investigate the causes of the riots, including an SBA official called Eugene Foley. And then the government after the 68 riots following Martin Luther King Jr.'s assassination, the government again with the SBA participated in a conference to help to ameliorate the problems that were being observed in inner cities, and here you see the government partnering with fast food franchises as well as with other businesses.
Right, and this is an interesting point, the Small Business Administration, because when you talk about a fast food franchise, at that time they're growing, they're not quite as large as they are. Now they're sort of these multinational corporations. But why are these bigger corporations able to get the help from the Small Business Administration?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, that name, Small Business Administration, connotes, kind of mom and pop businesses, right? Not necessarily these multinational conglomerates. A lot of these fast food restaurants today are owned by private equity firms. Yeah, so the Small Business Administration makes individual franchises, if they're owned by individuals or groups and not owned by the corporations, makes them eligible for these loans as long as their receipts total less than $5 million and as long as the corporate franchisor gives their individual franchisees the quote-unquote right to earn their profits. So despite the fact that these individual franchises have to pay various franchising fees, advertising fees, sometimes their buildings are leased by the corporation that the franchisor, they are still seen as independent entrepreneurs.
And you write that the SBA, the Small Business Administration, seem to make a concerted effort to look for instance, African-American franchise owners. And so it could be seen as an effort to revitalize the economies of these communities, get some small businesses in there. Did it work out that way?
Yeah, well, first I should point out that the Small Business Administration, in terms of urban renewal after the 60s, they're not necessarily the ones that are primarily driving minority business initiatives. We see that starting with the Nixon administration's establishment of the Office of Minority Business Enterprise in 1969, and I should point out it's now called the Minority Business Development Agency. But so it's the OMBE and various other initiatives through either, you know, the Department of Health and Human Services or the HUD, Housing and Urban Development, where minority business initiatives as well as urban renewal programs, they're primarily housed within those other agencies. And so has it worked out that way in terms of kind of has the economic developments that that policymakers may have been hoping for, has that happened? Well, it's interesting that, you know, there were critiques going back to the 60s. So there was an economist, a Federal Reserve economist named Andrew Brimmer, who was saying, and he was, I believe, one of the first African-American economists with the Federal Reserve. You know, and his critique was, you know, we need to focus on integrating African-Americans within the broader, quote-unquote, mainstream economy instead of limiting them, confining them to African-American neighborhoods. We need to focus on, job training and getting them kind of these corporate jobs instead of just trying to develop these small businesses within African-American communities. And also what we see in terms of job creation is that some of your listeners may be aware with the current fast food workers minimum wage efforts to raise the minimum wage in a lot of America's large cities, especially, you know, in places like New York and the Bay Area and California, it's really difficult to survive solely on fast food wages. So, you know, the fast food companies might say, well, these wages are just meant to supplement, let's say, high schoolers' income. But what we know is that a lot of these workers, they're kind of the primary breadwinners in their families. And so it really, you know, isn't enough, especially if you're an entry-level fast food worker in America's expensive mm-hmm. cities to earn a decent living on these wages.
I wanted to ask if you could paint us a picture of how the landscape changed if you look at those riots in the late 60s and the opening that created to bring in some of these fast food franchises into inner cities, sometimes poorer communities, sometimes primarily minority communities. What does the landscape look like in terms of how many, what the density of fast food restaurants between then and now and later?
Yeah, so before the late 60s, inner city communities were without these familiar fast food chains. And now what we see, you know, is a transformation of the urban food landscape. There are some exceptions. For instance, the RAND Corporation has published studies showing that that South Los Angeles, which is primarily minority low-income neighborhood relative to the more affluent West Los Angeles, for instance, in that case, they found that that South Los Angeles actually had fewer fast food restaurants, but still, higher rates of obesity than the West. But Los Angeles is kind of an exception. There are still, a lot of bodegas, these convenience stores that sell fast food. That sell processed foods. But in other parts of the country, you know, for instance, the South Bronx, which is primarily Latino and African American, you see just fast food restaurant after fast food restaurant and higher than average rates of obesity. You know, there was also a study done on New Orleans, which showed that African American communities in New Orleans had far more fast food restaurants than white communities. And to get back to kind of your earlier question, I should qualify what I was saying in terms of job creation, and that there we've seen kind of limited effects to fast food in that, but in terms of kind of creating minority entrepreneurs. You know, that fast food has resulted in, you know, some wealthy entrepreneurs. So, for instance, you know, the Black McDonald's Operators Association, you know, likes to point out, for instance, that McDonald's has created more African-American millionaires than any other corporation. And it's also been pointed out that, that, you know, kind of a lot of the high-level executives and also the franchise owners from McDonald's, for instance, they've risen through the ranks, and that not a lot of Fortune 500 companies can claim that their high-level executives kind of started at the bottom of the company. So in terms of entrepreneurs, you know, there have been some commendable developments. Also, McDonald's likes to boast that 45% of its owner operators are women and minority. It's not clear what the breakdown of that percent is, but yeah, I mean, it's a qualified outcome, I would say, especially when it comes to jobs.
And Tim, we leave it there. There's a lot more to get into, but I appreciate your time and joining us today.
Well, thanks very much for having me.
That was Chin Zhou, a lecturer in American history at the University of Sydney. She's the author of the book Supersizing Urban America, How Inner Cities Got Fast Food with Government Help.